I, Kitty, once, Gerald. Gerald's the, you know, because of Gerald's thing about cats.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Oh. Am I introing? Are we going? We're going. What should the left do? With Tracy James. Who? What is the left?
Well, personally, I think that, let's take it from the American context. The left is shattered up in many definitions. You have people who call themselves left, who believe in the Democratic Party, and they believe that the best or major way forward for progress is tied within the Democratic Party, i.e. through voting and quote-unquote progressive elected officials, writing to senators and things of that nature concerning the environment, so on and so forth. There are those of us who believe that the market system itself is fundamentally in opposition to the well-being of human conditions, species conditions, and environmental stability. We've seen three holes punched in the ozone. We've seen glaciers that in the Arctic, where 150 square mile glacier has broken off 80 miles thick as a result of global warming. We've seen in the Mississippi River a dead zone where it's completely oxygenated. This is all part of a market-based system, and there's nothing that a Democrat can do with his or her reforms, or a Republican can do with his or her reforms, that can stop the onward progression of the domination of human life, of species life, of insect life, and the detriment of the planet. Those of us who are on the left of my persuasion believe that we have to create a world that is in opposition to a market-based winners, losers, slaver system. There has to be given a certain form of autonomy to the human rights and human well-beings for social progress. It's kind of fascinating that you've seen a situation that is this highly developed from a technological standpoint. In the 1930s and 40s, when the 40-hour work week was...
Let's just sit back, Frank.
When the 40-hour work week was developed... many people realize that that was for those times, you know, 40-hour work week, and even then it could have been reduced more to have all the workforce work. But now we're in the year 2004, and they still have the 40-hour work week. It's not reduced down to, like, you know, 15 or 12 like it should be. Still paying everyone full time. In other words, what I'm saying is the technology that humans have developed has been turned against them, and it hasn't been a benefit for the human condition outside of false peripheral stuff, cell phones and stuff like that. But as far as humans having more time to develop themselves, to develop their communities, to develop better relationships with other, you know, so what I'm saying is that those of us who are on the left of my persuasion think that the world is split and divided in different ways. And a market-based system, from my left worldview, is not a world that I want to be a part of.
This S-H-O, this show, S-T, started when A. Neighbor. We were at a neighbor's Christmas party, and she had been drinking. And she was a big supporter of Howard Dean, who at that point was doing very well. And she's German.
Mm-hmm.
Emma. O. V. Move. Oh, MoveOn.org. Very big supporter of MoveOn.org.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up to Frank and really was trying to engage him in a debate. And she characterized Frank as way left of her. And that he kind of, then she kind of put him in a position of having to defend what she saw as the problem. That she thought the progressives were the problem in the way that they had been the problem in Germany when Hitler was coming to power. She said the progressives failed in Germany and they're failing again. And what we need to do is to give up our personal desires. She said she's a lesbian, and she said Dean doesn't represent her views on that, but she's willing to put that aside for the greater good. And she thought everybody should rally behind him to defeat Bush.
And how is that defined as the greater good? I mean, in other words, see, that's part of the problem with pseudo-progressives. They often criticize the right for developing these sound bites, but then they turn around and create them themselves with this anyone but Bush, lesser of two evils. What exactly does that mean? In other words, the left has had all the time, or those like her in the left, quote-unquote, have all the time in the world to develop a program that has a list of things. Do you support the School of the Americas? Do you support the State of Israel? Right down the line. And if their particular candidates answer in a negative at a certain percentage that is all agreed upon among the little lesser of two evils types of, you know, Michael Parente types, then they could say...
A future guest of the Shaman's
then they can say, okay, well, you can't be considered a lesser of two evil candidate. See, the thing is that they know in their heart there's no level of barbarity that a Democrat won't stoop to. Here, the case in point, all of this stuff about Germany, Henry Ford and the Jews, fascism and big business, saving private power, IBM and the Holocaust. Four books. Get one of those fours, and one thing you'll realize right off is that when Hitler was in crisis against the various movements that were going on in Germany, it was not a given that he was going to win. What side did big business capitalism join on? Henry Ford wrote the anti-Semitic book, International Jews, which Hitler loved so much that he put a big picture of Hitler in his antechamber. He actually gave Henry Ford the Iron Cross, where there's a picture of Henry Ford receiving the cross. You had General Electric supply electrical power to the Nazis during the Nazi regime. You had Standard turn around and show the Nazis how to develop other fuels into aviation fuel to keep their war machine going on down the long barbaric line. And at that crucial point in time, when the Nazis were involved in the liquidation of European Jewry, of communists, of gypsies, where were the Democrats and Republicans? They were goose-stepping right behind them. That's the real world. See, we don't even have to talk on a certain level about Bush and them who are sliding into fascism. We know they're using fascistic-like tendencies. My whole point is that there's a historical record to where the Democrats sided on during a crisis of a world body, a world government, or a government sliding into fascism. And they were on the side of where their big capitalist masters were. Where big business were, that's where they were. And that's where they'll be till the end.
And after The war. They did not want to let the Jews in to their this see country.
They didn't want the Jews into this country. The Nazi type of program actually got started in Africa. This is not well known in Hotteland. And that's part of the southern region of Africa, where many of those legendary Nazi doctors were practicing their extermination program in Africa at the time. And they decided to exterminate a large portion of the population. No cry from the U.S. Red, white, and blue. We're expendable in a market-based system because that's the way it's orientated.
We did it to the N.A. Native Americans.
In 1863, the United States government and society slipped into its worst depression to date at that time. Millions of people were out of work. The various papers at the time said it was because of the big business bankers, because of the railroad and greedy capitalists. This is their words. These are the capitalist words about themselves. What was their way of getting out of it? They looked over towards the Black Hills, and they knew that the Black Hills were loaded with gold. Even though the U.S. had conceded that land to Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Two Moon, and the rest of the Dakotas. But in a market-based system where you are based on expansionism and terror, a treaty basically means nothing if the other side does not have the arms to defend themselves against your barbarity. So they basically ripped up that treaty, sent George Armstrong Custard into the Black Hills. He did this, there's gold in them hills. And then that led off the next wave of assault and genocide amongst the native population. So when the market system in America failed, and it had nothing to do with anyone else, no outside influence, it failed on its own economic system and toppled over, it used other people's land, other people's resources, and other people for the liquidation of the other people to keep its empire going. That's the hallmark of this system, and that's the mindset of those who run this society.
Are not we are you and running out of people to exploit?
Well, it's a situation where the resources is a situation that they're going to keep on trying to expand. This is all this whole Silk Road Corridor strategy that they're doing in Eurasia, kind of described in Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard strategy of next stages of imperial aggression, the battles over how to maintain the world societies in a dead energy system, you know, petroleum and stuff like that, where we have solar power and wind power, which are living energy systems. But these living energy systems are neglected and neutralized by a market system that wants to keep people locked into a system that they have strong control in. And at the same time, they can control those people. So a lot of things, in my opinion, are kind of running out. I think in some ways we're running out of time because the ocean itself is becoming destroyed.
Even the Pentagon thinks we're running out of time.
Well, they in the London paper, a few days ago. It described how the Pentagon's own scientific analysis has said that the world is heading towards all types of climatic deprivation, which will help create many wars and so on and so forth. They had also done other studies where they said that the next source of wars were going to be over basic things like water. I had long been saying that many of the things that are going to be a basic common struggle to people and hopefully crystallize in the masses of people's minds how detrimental this society is that our basic forms of living are going to be severely threatened, meaning water, air, and food. We're talking, those are just basics. Right now we see that most people use, you know, bottled water because, you know, who knows what's coming out of this, you know, they keep raising the arsenic levels, so on and so forth. Certain regions of the country have good to very, very bad air days. And we've seen what they are doing to the genetically modified foods, which ramifications to the ecosystem holds no bounds, and the depletion of the ocean's stock of massive supplies of tuna and so on and so forth. And when they do catch, like one tuna recently in Japan, bluefin tuna sold for over $150,000. This is madness. Now, the market system, though, but see, this is how the market system works. In a civilized world, if something was to become so rare and on the verge of extinction, people who are looking for and maintaining a stable planet would say, we need to leave these things alone and let them possibly try to resupply themselves. But in a market system, that just makes those fish more valuable. The fewer they become, the more valuable they become. So there's more of an incentive to go after them right to the very last one.
If you want a D-E-F-I-N definition of I-N-S insanity, that is it.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed this sister from Kenya who was trying to block all of these dams that are being built throughout India and Africa and stuff like that, because many times they're not even needed. But the World Bank and IMF policies through structural adjustment force people in, or these various little governments, into these situations where they build these things. Now, recently, in Kenya, primates, meaning humans and monkeys, got into a fierce battle with each other over some water. What happened was, as it was reported in Kenya, much of the land had been dried out because these dams get built. It creates these, like, you know, dust bowl zones. Lakes dry out because they don't go into other areas, to, you know, like they once did, because the natural flow has been erupted. So many of the habitats that these monkeys lived in, and humans for that matter, had become dry dust bowls. So when some people had bought some water supply over to the humans, the monkeys saw this and they had been driven insane for a lack of from a lack of water, and actually started fighting the humans over water. Now, that's the definition of insanity in its truest form, all created by a market-based system that the world, unfortunately, is locked into. When you have India, which is the second largest producer of food, have millions of people going who are starving, even though they have enough food to feed those people, but in a market-based system, it's not whether or not you live in a society that has enough food to feed you, it's whether you have enough money to pay into the system to get that food.
I K-E, kept, A, asking, the, N, E, the neighbor, why should I vote for Dean? Not why is B, not why is Bush B A bad, but why should I vote for Dean? She could not give one reason.
Well, that's often because they can easily metamorphose, hypothetically speaking, from one group to another. What I mean by that is that recently, you know, when another individual was running for office, Clark, a lot of fanfare was made about it. I'm going to read you something about what had happened. Clark had only declared as a Democrat this past August. People asked why. A Newsweek article kind of gave an indication. What happened during the war on terror? Because, quote, after all, he'd been NATO commander, and the investment firm he now worked for has strong Bush ties. But when GOP friends inquired, they were told, forget it. Word was that Karl Rove, the president's political mastermind, had blocked the idea. Clark was furious. Clark happened to chat with two prominent Republicans, Colorado Governor Bill Owens and Mark Holtzman. Clark says, quote, I would have been a Republican, Clark told him, if Karl Rove had returned my phone calls. Thereafter, in fact, Clark quit his day job and began seriously planning to enter the presidential race as a Democrat. Now, look, the only reason why Clark turned to the Democrats is because he was personally insulted that he wasn't enlisted in, of all things, this war on the masses of human rights of people, also called the war on terror. Mm. It had nothing to do with, quote unquote, his political alignment with the Democrats. Is something he sees that he's closer to, because at the end of the day, both Democrats and Republicans know who they serve and what particular interests they serve. You know, I've had certain questions that, you know, I've wanted myself, certain people who say that they're Democrats or support the lesser of two evil concepts to answer to. And I've often come to no avail on that also. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that at the end of the day, one has to ask this. One has to be honest. You know, and just think of this. Think about this. Do the Democrats want the U.S. empire to grow and expand and be dominant throughout the rest of the world? And under a market system, what does that mean for militarism, nationalism, and ethnic divisions? In other words, is it just the Republicans who want the U.S. Mm-hmm. empire to be the dominant? I think we know the answer to that. Do Democrats want the U.S. to be the sole superpower? And what are those ramifications? Will Democrats create an oppositional base for alternative energy and go against the corporate energy, dead energy conglomerates? Mm-hmm. What has the Democrats done to stop the privatization of water on a national and global scale, where we've seen in areas like from Colombia to Argentina, the privatization of water and the effects. What has the Democrats done to stop the IMF World Bank structural adjustment imperial policies? In other words, this is part of the natural imperial policies and mandates through neoliberal policies that the U.S. empire has implemented on the third world especially. And we've seen the disastrous effects that it has had. Can anyone honestly say that the Democrats pose any kind of true opposition to those particular policies any different than the Republicans? See, these are the foundations of the crisis, the global crisis that we find ourselves in. So to get into this kind of lesser of two evils things, like I was saying before, without defining what it means to be a lesser of two evils, is it's basically tap dancing in the dark and also reducing people down to a sloganeering type of mentality. In other words, instead of us hammering out analytically some of these issues concretely to thereby get to some strategies concretely, many of these liberal types turn around and throw the same type of slogans, Bill O'Reilly type slogans, you know, anyone but Bush, that they complain about the right wing doing.
Will they see you cut the M I L military budget for B by at least half and use the money for people?
Well, I mean, you have a situation where during Crime Bill Clinton's administration, he intentionally targeted the working class and poor through his, you know, anti-welfare, not corporate welfare. This was to intentionally weaken the working class. Now, when you look at the welfare...
H-E-Hey. Clinton, C. O. R. Corporations, corporation, C-O-R-P, O. Corporate, W. Welfare, is B. I. L. Billions, and W. E. Welfare, of for the poor, M I millions, N A T U naturally, P L U G plug the M I millions T not the billions.
Right. While it's just the millions for welfare, working class welfare, it's a psychological, amongst other forms, of a safety net. And this is also psychops that they're engaged on us in the same way that they're using psychops in Haiti right now. So if you can strip that away from masses of people, you can also get them in line, because the hallmark of really attacking the welfare system started in the early 70s, late 60s, when a major corporation lost a strike against its workers. And when they started to investigate how they lost the strike, they saw that not only were the workers getting money from their unions while on the strike, but they were receiving AFDC. So for their perspective, that was the state helping workers defeat them. That's not acceptable. So at that time, they decided to systematically and strategically go after the welfare system. Now, they couldn't just come out and say that, mm-hmm. so they had to play a little Reefer Madness style of game, mm-hmm. how they typically do it, where they pigeonhole a particular issue as being the social ills of the undesirables. So a lot of the war on drug aspect is based in the Southern strategy that Nixon and them developed, and that was really to kind of divide the Democratic base. But what they did was they pinned drug use on the young, the poor, and the black. The young at the time were the hippies and stuff like that, so they're antisocial, anti-American. The poor are lazy, so they're anti-American, quote-unquote, and blacks, well, you know. And then, so with that hallmark, by using that strategy, they were able to foster in the war on drugs. Now, their overall goal was to control and regiment the population even more so, to melt down a lot of the political and social organizations that were calling the question the legitimacy of the state. So if you can flip it and wage war on them under a different disguise, then you can help control the population even more. But once again, they couldn't just come out and say that, so they just flipped it by just trying to pretend that they were trying to maintain some kind of safety within the society. So these strategies are used in many ways to psychologically beat people down and have them turn against each other and create artificial illusions that there are significant differences amongst someone who's working for McDonald's making $4.75 an hour and someone who's working for Burger King that's making $4.75 an hour. You know, that's just the way the game is played.
My M O N, my money, four, oh, attendance, right, that's on the chopping block, the money that Frank gets paid to have attendance. Mm. Over the past few years, it's gotten to where it's up to like $9.50 an hour, which is still, you know, not very much, and they just added medical and dental benefits. And they got a union, right? The workers, that's how it all happened. The workers were unionized, and then all of a sudden started getting raises quickly over a couple-year period, and then medical and dental. And now Schwarzenegger is proposing that it gets cut back down to $6.75 an hour and takes the medical and dental benefits. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff where some people just will lose attendance altogether.
Well, it's this classic class warfare. Mm. Over the last, 22 years, they've built 20-plus prisons and one university. Now, how they bamboozled people was they had people thinking that it was some black kid from McClimas High with a 1.2 average that was getting into the University of Berkeley, thereby stopping a white student with a 4.0. The reality was that the population has been growing all over, especially in California. Many people are trying to get into colleges. Many people come with, quote-unquote, the right four grade point averages and SAT scores, but there's less availability because they've been emphasizing building prisons as opposed to expanding the school systems. But they flipped it as, them playing the race card as if it's someone else who has basically the same point grade average as you do who's stopping you from getting in because of the color of their skin. Then the whole thing blows up when a couple of years ago, over 400 black students who had 4.0s and high SATs didn't get admitted either to the University of Berkeley. But then, now just this year, 20,000 students are not going to become freshmen this year, and at least six colleges are not accepting any it doesn't matter what color you are. In other words, the whole thing has funneled to a point where everything has gone bank. Now, there's room for you in the prisons, but that's where their priorities were. But since they had many people thinking that this was not the type of class attack and fierceness that it actually was, that they got them off of thinking that this is class warfare from a dominant, you know, corporate class system. And often what ends up happening is if it's a Democrat, you know, or Democrats who hold office, people often who call themselves progressives let their critical eye down and thinking in these terms of class warfare. So, you know, all during this whole escalation of the prison industrial complex buildup, it was primarily Democrats who were at the helm, Democratic mayors, you know, Democratic governors, et cetera, et cetera. And people allowed themselves to get caught up thinking that this was just over, quote unquote, affirmative action, when in reality, they were manipulating and gearing up a class warfare attack by building all of these prisons, filling up these prisons through the drug wars, drug laws, as a class attack, like I mentioned earlier, to basically subjugate the people. So, once again, you have a situation where class warfare was being played primarily by Democrats in California against the masses of people who, and it was basically them building all of these prisons. It was them who were leaving the college institutions alone from being expanded like they should have been. And then when all of this explodes, all of this time and analysis I was saying that could have been sharpened about what's really going on was missed.
And it is not R-E-A-L, really, A, about M-O, money, but when, where, the M-O money G-O goes to, it's not really about money, but where the money goes to.
Yeah, basically it's talking distribution. In other words, it's money in many ways is similar to like food. It's not that there's a lack of food in the world to feed people many times over. It's the distribution networks that's based in a market system. The same thing with money. There is more than enough money, quote unquote, in this society and in the world for human beings to all live in a decent, stable way. But we have a market system that's also aligned itself with control, because being a marketeer means that you control markets, and human beings, other species, the environment all become players in that market and are all victims of being manipulated within that market. So you have some people who hoard up the majority of quote unquote the markets, i.e. money and other things, whereas others wallow in poverty.
It C O cost more, much more, to P U put people in institutions of whatever type, then it costs for, right, and this, right, then it costs, like, for the, with the whole disabled thing, this, which is what we're involved in, it's like the people that are going to lose the attendance will have to end up in institutions, and obviously it's going to cost more to institutionalize them than to pay somebody to come and help them, you know, eat their food and get dressed and stuff, but the money will not be going to the attendant, it'll be going to the corporations that own the institutions.
Right, and it costs more to who? Because many of these people who end up in these institutions will not be well served. Their quality of life will go down.
Way down.
You know?
Yes.
So,
they will die.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's just the way it's designed. I mean, this society is set up for some people, a large portion of the people, to be quote-unquote disposable. You can be disposable of your political orientation, but you can also be disposable because of your quote-unquote powerlessness within a particular type of regime like this. Mm. And that makes you vulnerable. You know, you can be disposable once you serve your duty in the Persian Gulf War. Look, 200,000 Gulf War soldiers have Gulf War syndrome. This is not any kind of national mandate to help these guys. They're disposable. They served their little purpose for the U.S. Empire, and now they can go off and die. Same with the Vietnam vets. And those who come slumping out of this current crisis in Iraq will be just as disposable. That's the type of society that exists in America.
Jay, you just B-I-B-O X boxes to B-W-A-R-E warehoused. The people are just boxes to be warehoused.
Well, I mean, it's like the U.S. Empire never stopped its manifest destiny, which was a form of westward expansionism in the greater good of the industrialists. Once it conquered the U.S. landscape, or what became the U.S. landscape, it continued its westward expansion throughout the Philippines and Hawaii and South America, and now the world. Now the world is being turned into a giant Indian reservation. This is the mindset and mentality. This is the type of reasoning that leads those in power here to believe that they can go over and thrust depleted uranium all over the landscape in Iraq, to the point where 40 to 45% of the population is going to have some kind of ill effect just directly related to the depleted uranium. And this is all about the seizure and control of the products under these people's feet. Now, the only way you can get into that mindset is if you feel that certain people have a right, certain people don't. And it comes down to who has power and alignments of power. Those who don't can be boxed off and shipped off, basically either into the sea or into the graveyard.
That gets R-I-D rid of the 9 of the wood of the would be L E A D leaders.
That what?
That gets rid of the would-be leaders.
All right. It also disciplines them. In other words, like the School of the Americas is basically was designed to discipline primarily South America at the time and make sure that those people who thought outside of the box and tried to have any form of society that went outside of the box that Sam dictates, they would find themselves under the gun of those people trained at the School of the Americas. If you look at South America, you don't see like Brazil fighting Argentina and Argentina fighting Chile and all of this. Yet all of them have these gigantic standing armies. What are these armies for? They're used historically to crush its own population. And much of the training that many of these standing armies have gotten and certain top officials has all been in Fort Benning's School of the Americas, is to discipline the people within these particular societies. We see that happening in Haiti right now. We've seen this happen over and over again. I mean, Toto Constant was the co-founder of FRAP, but FRAP was put together and organized by the CIA. When Aristide first ran in 1990, he ran promising to put in minimum a wage, Social Security, child labor laws, environmental regulations. Spalding Baseball, Nestle's Chocolate, Mickey Mouse, all of them who were down there did not like it because he was thinking outside of the box and trying to act on it. But Aristide got 67% of the vote. The U.S. had a candidate that they backed, but he only got 13%. So Aristide overwhelmingly got the mandate from the people. So then the U.S. started to fund another type of opposition group, a terrorist group. And that's where you saw the emergence of FRAP. And then they decimated the leaders and people of the Lavalas, ran Aristide out the country. This is where the Democrats come in. Then the Democrats come in, and Crime Bill Clinton says, okay, I'm going to restore Aristide back into office. But he said, you have to follow the structural adjustment programs, which means the destruction of your whole program that you had promised to the masses of people. He funded and channeled millions of dollars to the terrorists who had escaped out of the country, basically through the networks of the U.S. Many of them went to the Dominican Republic. Toto Constant was living in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. So during the whole Clinton administration, there was even a soldier, Lawrence Lockwood, who came in and saw at least 600 Lavalas people who were locked up in prison during the time of the terrorist control. So Aristide gets brought back. This soldier sees these people, and he was under the mindset that, okay, well, Crime Bill, you know, he said he's bringing Aristide back, he'll free all these innocent people and so on and so forth, and let Aristide, you know, continue his government and all of that type of stuff. Instead, Crime Bill and them maintained those people in prison, and they just disappeared away. So a core of the people who were a part of the progressive movement in Haiti were liquidated systematically away during the whole democratic period. They brought Aristide back in chains, basically. In other words, they neutralized him from being able to implement his policies. He was gone for a number of years. Within the first 9 months, he gets expelled. The term of the presidency in Haiti is 5 years. Now, when he came back, instead of having him finish the 4 years, 3 months of his time, they said, no, you're just going to finish from as if you never left. So, and then they said, you can't run again. you know, you can't just run, you know, consecutively, which you can do under their constitution, just like you can here. So that's why he just finished off his presidency, and then there was a lapse in time, and then he just started running again, you know, a couple of years ago. But there was a gap between, you know, that was all systematically done by the U.S. Meanwhile, it's funding and pampering and developing these terrorists for the next go around. That was all done during the Democratic administrations. So then Boy George jumps into office and this kind of finishes it off. And of course, you'll have many Democrats, you know, wringing their hands and stuff like that. But basically, Crime Bill Clinton's administration handed the baton to Boy George to finish off the deal. That's what happened. And that's how these policies play themselves out.
B E T between the time we S E T set this up and now D. Dean is out of the presidential race. K. E.
Kerry.
L. O. Looks like he's going to be the one that gets the nomination. And N. Nader is running. And my L I liberal neighbor B backed out of this interview.
Well, you know, it's kind of fascinating that when Nader ran the last time, to get into the presidential debates, you need a projected 5% of the vote. The Democrats got together with the Republicans and raised the bar from 5 to 15%, exposing the fact that the Democrats do not care any more about the democratic process any more than the Republicans. At the very least, you would expect, if there was some fundamental difference between the Democrats and Republicans, that the Democrats would at least say, no. He at least deserves the right to get into the debates. But they don't respect that any more than the Republicans do. If you don't respect the right of a participatory government when, under your own guidelines that you set up, people are supposed to be able to participate, then everything else that you're doing and running is a sham.
Are you... G O going to vote?
No.
What? When was the last time you voted?
You mean like for president?
Do you mean for president? Yes.
Never.
But do you vote for L O local?
If I think it is something that's genuine, you know, then I have no problem with, you know, those types of specific local issues. But as far as like the issues concerning presidents and all of that, I don't, you know, have any kind of, I don't have any illusions about it. Look, the most important advancement black people have made in this country was during the Civil War. It's not during the Civil Rights Movement, because people love to just go on and on about King. And it had a lot to do with the role that Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman played. In examining the crisis of the slaveocracy system and the economic implications of it. You had a situation where the North and the South, which were both expanding their empires, every state that was being basically confiscated from some indigenous people, the debate would raise free state or slave state. Now, if you were an owner in the North, you had to pay your labor. If you were an owner in the South, you had slave labor. So from an industrialist class perspective, you had class conflict. And Frederick Douglass and them understood that this contradiction could implode because you have two competing class conflicts within the society. Now, what he did was is he started his own independent network, newspaper, the North Star. He examined it. He debated with other abolitionists who were the revolutionaries of the time. You had many who were saying, no, we must participate. Black people should only participate in this struggle nonviolently. Frederick Douglass said, look, any way we can end this, we will, and so on and so forth. He got a large block of people under his particular mindset. They kept pushing the agenda. And when the crisis of the slaveocracy system imploded and a civil war broke out, Frederick Douglass and them seized the opportunity to for black people to take a role in crushing the slaveocracy system. It wasn't that he had any illusions about the North. He just saw that the crisis in the system that had been created, and 200,000 plus black people joined the North to crush the South, thus ending chattel slavery as we know it. If that had not been done, there's no guarantee that that the North would have won, and thus black people would have still been under chattel slavery. Even Lincoln himself admitted that if it wasn't for black participation, the South would more than likely have won. So the most important advancement black people have made was the crushing of chattel slavery. You can't compare the crushing of chattel slavery to some reform movements. As important as the civil rights movement was, the crushing of chattel slavery was insurmountable. My whole point in mentioning this was that all of this was done within the understanding of having your own independent networks and voice, your own independent federations and organizations, and your own independent understanding of the market slave system that existed. To have illusions about one party or another or whatever.
But the LI, the liberals, say if you ask the POO, if you ask the poor if they are BET better off under Democrats or Republicans, that the poor will say that they're better off under Democrats. S. So that is a reason to vote Democrat.
Well, just because. Now, this is me accepting that analysis. This just because someone, quote unquote, may have an illusion about something does not mean that it's right. First of all, though, I don't think that necessarily the poor overall believe that they're better off. I think a lot of that's more propaganda. I think that's why many of the liberals are just as scared from organizing the poor as the conservatives and want to keep them disenfranchised. Look at the voting rate and percentage in this society, it's pretty clear that the vast majority of poor people aren't participating in the votes. So they don't really know. They know that they have a large disaffected majority of poor people within this society, and actually a small percentage of people decide which bourgeois party is going to get into office or not. So once again, that's just them throwing down slogans and claims and stuff without being forced to substantiate it. Now, the other aspect is that a large portion of, when you have a large portion of the American society not be able to find Iraq on the map, not know, 80%, at least those who watch Fox News, 80% think that Saddam was involved in 9/11, that he had terrorist links to Al Qaeda, and you know, and all, or that he still had weapons of mass destruction before the war started, on and on. We're talking about a very confused and misinformed large portion of the American society, and it's not by coincidence. So what I'm saying is that the average liberal would say, well, yeah, the reason why a large portion of the American population believe one of those three things is because they're being manipulated by the corporate media and the way things are spun in this society. Yet, they'll turn around and say that the majority of poor people with support the Democrats, and that's why everyone who's progressive support the Democrats, without any hint of, well, maybe these people who are poor, who believe that, are being manipulated. In other words, it's a hypocrisy at its highest form. They want to analyze honestly, like many other people do, the way this society spins things through its corporate media networks to give you the illusion about certain things in this society. But when it fits the particular script that often they're involved in spinning, then they just want you to go ahead and swallow it.
S. So, if V. If voting is not a way to change things, what is?
Well, I think that, you know, when you talk about voting, I think that, one, we have to understand what system and mechanism we're talking about. In other words, who we're voting for and in what box we're talking about. If we start to form our own networks and committees of various things, of autonomy, self-defense, etc., and start voting in people into these particular types of positions and roles and all of that, see, that's real voting and stuff, real networking. Like what's going on in Haiti right now, a lot of things should and could and hopefully possibly will be getting done concerning the networks that exist in Haiti, in America, in Venezuela, places like that, who have a common interest to start to channel like funds, supplies of various things, from water to, you know, self-defense instruments, to the people of Haiti so that they can help defend themselves. Now, we can organize these types of committees. We have the means and ability, but often people are locked into writing to their legislators that they quote-unquote vote in as the answer. Right now, you hear many people talking now, you know, Barbara Lee telling people to write to Colin Powell, write to her, so that they can show Boy George that we know what he's doing. Of course he knows, you know, that's their game plan. So, in other words, what I'm saying is a lot of time is being spent in writing letters to people who are voted into office who are part of that matrix, as opposed to people that we have developed within our own independent institutions to make decisions. The important votes that Frederick Douglass made had nothing to do with the Democrat or Republican parties. They were votes that he had independently had developed within the abolitionist movement about how to go about dealing with the slave system. Those type of votes had the fundamental fundamental impact on the world of crushing the slave system. So if we think about votes within the parameters of the ruling class,
they
will be twisted forever.
They don't want us to know that. They don't want us to know that, the stuff that Tracy was just saying.
And they don't want us to think that there's another way of thinking, that there's another way, in other words, that there are various networks in Haiti that could have and still could use some funds, and that there's ways of getting money to a lot of desperate people in these serious situations right now. If you look, most of the discussion going on, even on like KPFA, has to do with, of course, informing yourself, which is important, but then writing to a particular congressman, going to a rally, you know, and protesting at the federal building and stuff like that, as opposed to going to a protest at the federal and then getting some people together to network, to channel some, you know, collaboration with the people who are in that dire situation, channel them, you know, various means to defend themselves who are in these dire situations. In other words, those who are within the ruling class circles of America, they know what they're doing and they know what can and cannot stop them. Threats of faxes of letters coming through aren't going to stop them.
They are. S-C-A. Scared.
Well, I mean, if the average punk dude who slaps his wife around is scared quite often when he goes to bed at night. This clown may not admit it, but, you know, if he's coward enough to beat up on his wife and stuff like that, he doesn't know if one day he may not wake up the next morning. Now, if that same guy had 50 wives in his house and was doing it to all of them, he knows that there's really a possibility that there that he may not. the reality is that the ruling class is vastly outnumbered. They know it. They know what they're doing. They may have clowns here who don't really know what they're doing because they think that they can vote another one in to do the same job, but just with a smile on their face and with a D tattooed to their head as opposed to an R. But they are clear about what they're doing. They understand. They spent years in destroying organizations throughout the American landscape. At one time, there were hundreds of independent union-based newspapers that just didn't talk about union affairs, but talked about war, world affairs, but it had a class perspective. That's outside of the box that they want you locked into. So they destroyed those union-based newspaper institutions. At one time, black people were the most organized people in the country. Black people were involved in some kind of organ, you know, either the church or, you know, SNCC, Panthers or something. They systematically destroyed those institutions. They systematically thrust the drugs into those communities. They intentionally implemented urban renewal programs, which intentionally destroy a lot of the commercial industrial bases within those societies throughout this country. In other words, they knew exactly what they were doing. They were conscious. This wasn't an accident. The COINTEL program is not something that, one guy in his bedroom by himself just wrote, you know, what if we did this? You know, this is something that they systematically use as a program of extermination, because they wanted to destroy the lifeblood of people and their institutions, which help organize and focus people in a way that serves as an engine for their own humanity and self-determination.
And even R A D radio, I radical, even radical, B U I no B B Y build no B U I that's all B U I even radical B U oh buy even radicals buy it.
Well, you know,
we get R, A, radicals, C, O, coming to us, say A, about S, T, A, are starting with the internet stations. We've had a number of times radical organizations that decide they want to do something like we're doing with Lover. Mm. Oh, sorry. radical organizations that say they want to do I forgot the mic. They want to do something like what we're doing with Lover, so they come to us and ask for advice. And when we tell them how you can do it cheaply and but get the job done, they don't believe us. They think that it should cost a lot of money and that they should reach thousands of people. And if they can't do that, and then it's not worth doing, so then they don't do anything.
Right. Well, like much of most people in this society base their worth kind of in the market-based society that we live in. So they often feel that they need the nod of approval by the standards set within this system to have any kind of legitimacy.
Yes.
And if they go outside of those types of matrix systems, then they're not really doing anything that's of any real value. They're just being, you know, kind of off on their own and all of that type of
stuff. Exactly.
So what you end up having, and this is, to me, kind of the core of the crisis of many liberals on this Democrat issue. Many of them deep down know that the Democratic Party is fundamentally no different than the Republicans. But at this time in the world, you have a system that says you can support the Republicans, you can support the Democrats passionately, but if you go outside that box, you're irrelevant. And for many people raised in this society, the thought of them being irrelevant is just too much for them to take. You know, in other words, they spent a lifetime involved in politics, writing books and stuff like that. And many of these books have been, you know, quite good, like, say, Parente. So for him to be considered irrelevant because of his position about the role of the Democrats and Republicans being fundamentally the same. So he's going to try to organize outside of that. That's a little bit too much for many people in this society, regardless of how well they analyze other things within this system. Now, there's many of us who all our lives in many ways have been told we're irrelevant.
He is V-O. Oh, he said he was voting for Kucinich. And then if Kucinich, which he's anticipating, won't be there, and then he's voting for Edwards, I think he said. Is that what he said?
He's going to vote for whatever Democrat at the end of the day. He can tap dance all around and all of that. At the end of the day, he's going to be pulling that lever for, you know. I mean, that's the
and
real world.
And he also said that he likes Nader and Nader is his friend. But
he's being pragmatic and all of that.
He won't vote for Nader and he wishes Nader wasn't running.
Right, right. And yeah, so once again, here you have, you know, someone who's written, you know, decent books and stuff like that, and takes himself seriously, and is often, you know, taken seriously and stuff, and has even challenged the legitimacy of the state on issues like the JFK assassination, where he firmly believes that the JFK assassination was within the matrix of the CIA and the, you know, the military state. Yet, with all of that, at the end of the day, you know, when it comes down to this saying, I have to draw a line on a system that is diametrically opposed from a class and human standpoint for the betterment of the larger society, he just tap dances right back in that box.
And that S.E. sends a message.
Well, I mean, yeah, it sends a couple of messages. One, it quote-unquote gives legitimacies to weaker liberals who, you know, may not be able to articulate as well as Parente, but then they can look over at him. It sends a message to the rulers, too, though, that there's a large segment of people who are supposed to be in more or less our camp, but who are still on the plantation. You know, the rest of us had packed the bags and then left with Harriet Tubman, and then we look back, and they're still on the plantation, you know, watching us walk off and stuff. You know, and they're not trying to burn the plantation down. You know, they're just standing on, you know. So.
And S-E-E-C, every, even, the, R, A, radical, L, E, A, leaders, even the radical leaders, want, have, need to be in the B O box to be E F effective S so don't G go outside the box. Now, that's the message that's being sent.
Right, right. In other words, like a lot of times you'll see people spend a lot of time going on about issues that the state and the corporate media blow up. A lot of times they're just used to point the finger at working class people and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But to look legitimate, many of them will engage in these discussions. So like right now, you'll see many radicals go, well, yeah, there shouldn't be steroid use in baseball, mm-hmm. and it's bad, and da 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 da. Now, all across the country, we've seen cops jacked up on steroids. Mm. Justin Velopi, the guy who plunged in Abner Louima's rectum, you know, the American flag or whatever obscene object it was. You know, the Miami River Boys. These were all jacked up cops on steroids, shooting innocent people, drug dealing, and all of that. Now, what would you think in a civilized society the priority would be? Concern about a silly athlete with a baseball bat on steroids, or a cop with a gun on steroids? But see, since this society is so twisted, many of these so-called progressives don't even think outside of the box when it comes to even issues like steroids and stuff. They'll focus in and complain about the athlete and get into these discussions. Yeah, it does mess up the legitimacy of the game and all of that type of stuff. Yet, steroid use by cops and how the cops after shootings don't have to immediately take tests and all of this other type of stuff, that's not even a discussion.
Or gay marriage, RAT rather than all, rather than why, is the government involved in people's relationships at that level?
Yeah, why is it not just a simple separation of church and state? Also, how are these clowns allowed to say stuff about this is, you know, traditional and all of that? Well, you know, from a traditional standpoint, the reason why the father used to walk down the aisle with the woman and quote unquote give her away is because the woman was considered property. Literally, that was the traditional marriage values system. Mm. When the preacher jumped up and said, "Is there anyone who says that, you know, this man should not marry this woman and all of that?" That's when, if anyone knew that the woman had been involved in a sexual affair, because she was supposed to be a virgin before this marriage, this was their time to stand up. Those are part of traditional marriage values, you know. Traditional American values said that black people couldn't marry whites and et cetera, et cetera. In other words, there were all types of mechanisms of control within the institution of marriage. And for many people, marriage has been an evolving, evolutionary type of thing. So when you hear these hypocrites talk about we want to go back to the traditional marriage type stuff without being called on, what exactly does that mean? We see once again how gumpified the population is.
They. And they never A. ask K. E. Carry. Why he doesn't want S same sex marriage?
Well, you know, like, what often happens is that it's the character myth syndrome. A lot of people, like Schultz, and you have all these different players. Schultz and them, Leo Schultz, was involved in developing the character myth. And this was the myth that if you present a political figure as having strong moral character, then people will analyze things that he says as contradictory towards those to his so-called character. They'll just kind of just look the other way and they'll just decimate away. So often you'll see the corporate media play a part into this whole role. And they'll do it for both the Democrats and Republicans because they want to create a character myth about these people who are supposed to play a pivotal role in our society. So Boy George is supposed to have a strong character myth. Colin Powell, you know, now Kerry's developing his character myth. So what they actually do often is not absorbed in people in the same way if they did not have that mythological image about them. It's like John Wayne. He was like the prototype character myth personality. This was a guy who was too scared to go to the war. It wasn't like he wasn't, you know, some kind of nationalist who didn't believe in the U.S. expansionism. But when it was his time to go from the draft, he, you know, he ran like a scared mouse. Yet the image of John Wayne through all his movies and stuff, you know, is this kind of swashbuckling G.I. Joe slash cowboy hero. It's a character myth. So when you see like Kerry and all of these guys develop this type of character myth, often the media help play a role in not trying to tarnish as much as possible that mythological image.
But even gays don't ask him what's wrong with why he doesn't want gay marriage.
Well, I've noticed that a lot of gays who are often Democrats do not really want to. It's like, look, you lock yourself in a box. Here, you're trying to say Democrats are fundamentally different. You know, we got to go Democrat. Now, if you were to drill Kerry on it, and all of a sudden he was to expose himself like he really was, that would basically help erode part of your argument for the need to go Democrat. So you have to gumpify yourself and put your own self in a box. A lot of these gays are putting their own self in a box. Now, there's a lot of log cabin Republicans who are upset. These are Republican gays who are inflamed because they see that the way Bush has used this whole manipulation thing, you know, as a strategy tool and stuff like that. So they're trying to come out and be more aggressive and stuff. But these are log cabin Republicans. The reason why they're shocked and kind of in disarray themselves now is because they've locked themselves in the log cabin for years. Look, they had all of this quote-unquote illusion that they created for themselves that any of these parties would accept them for who they are as long as they just kind of played out the, you know, American dream role and all of that without realizing that, you know, sexual preference, gender, and all of these things, these are often things that a corporate state like this intentionally uses to manipulate and divide people. It's not that many of these people really believe that there's all these fundamental differences between if a gay couple raises a kid, will they be worse off than if a straight couple raises the kid? But there are tools to manipulate the working class by. So if you don't take yourself seriously enough to honestly assess that stuff, and you lock yourself into the log cabin Republican house or some Democratic box, well, you're setting yourself up for, you know, a downfall down the road.
Who is T R A Tracy? Who is Tracy?
Revolutionary from West Oakland.
N O now we are getting to the G-O good, the good stuff.
We have a world in a society that's in an unnecessary crisis with unnecessary divisions, and it's tumbling into an unnecessary chaos. And there are those of us whose dispositions and personalities are not into artificial divisions and destructions of decent human beings throughout the world.
Why? Why not?
Well, it's like this. If you look, go around the world from Brazil to Mozambique, you'll see that...
most don't go around the world.
Okay.
Why?
If you go around your neighborhood.
Why do you? Why do you? The thing where he said before about the divisions. No, why do you? G, go. Oh, go around the world. When did your P-R-O B problem start? When did your problem start?
Well, basically, the problem, meaning Sam, started when I was born. I was born into a world that in many ways is artificial. You know, it has an artificial way of looking at people, an artificial way of judging other human beings. And I don't accept being artificially examined or put in any society or people's box. And
why? Why not?
Because I know there's much more to humanity and much more to the average person than what they try to project about other human beings. Including myself. So I don't allow a bunch of Indian killers, you know, this is an Indian killing society, to try to be the apex of how I look at other people. I don't try to look through their lenses. And I try to help personify the types of human beings that look through your own individual lens and find your own experience in humanity. Because when you look through someone else's lens, who has a lens that's bloodstained, you'll often get a distorted picture.
How did you F figure all that out?
That's really kind of hard to say. I mean, I've always been an independent thinker and just looked at myself and the environment that I lived in a way where the people that I know, the grandmothers I've had, you know, so on and so forth, great-grandmother. The image that I saw of them on TV was not them. the image that I saw of me was so different than the reality. The image of the people within the neighborhood that I, it was just so different than the way it's projected. You know, the way people often try to encounter me, thinking that they knew me, and it was clear that they were coming at me from some kind of artificial worldview, and often were shocked when encountering me, you know, a person to person, that I knew that, you know, that I was living in a society that intentionally tries to define people within an image that is extremely against any form of true harmony. And I just don't allow that. If you look at what was written, if you read the stuff that was written about various people at one time, you would get like one, like, let me put it this way. In the 1960s, if the average quote-unquote Americana-type person who believes in the American dream went into where Malcolm was speaking in Harlem, he would come out saying after that, that nigga's crazy. Then, say he went in and say, well, I'm going to go listen to James Baldwin. He's a noted speaker. He's more rational. And then he hear James Baldwin talking about the skeletons in America's closet. Then he would come out saying, man, that nigga's crazy. Then he goes, you know what? I'm going to go just listen to their musicians. I don't want to hear any more of them talking. And then they go and hear John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy, and they're playing all this, you know, futuristic stuff at the time. And then they come out saying basically what Downbeat magazine said, that the music was quote-unquote un-American, you know, that it was hate-filled. In other words, that these niggas were crazy. Then they say, well, you know what, I'm leaving all these males alone. I'm going to go hear Nina Simone. They go into a club and hear Nina Simone, and she's singing Mississippi Goddamn. And now, and then the same person would come out saying, all these niggas are crazy. Now, in the real world, they were all saying the same thing in different ways. And it was talking about the soul of a people and the humanity of a people and analyzing the society that we were in and what was the best way forward. But that meant that all of those individuals in their own different ways were thinking outside of the box. And that's a dangerous thing for many people who have always been in the box.
In L. A. Los Angeles, after A. S. H. After a show, S. H. O. Of F. E. Feisto. That's the movie that we made. When, where, I, P, play. Frank plays a creature from not here who shows up and through a relationship that he forms with a young kind of yuppie, disillusioned woman who kind of takes him on, his character is totally asocial. He breaks all the taboos. He doesn't, and that affects her. And so that's kind of the prism that the whole movie is through, them kind of their relationship and then how that affects the rest of her world. I... Always after the S, after the screening of the movie, I asked, I'm not sure which one you're talking about. You asked a woman what she thought of the movie, and she said, T-H, that, A, thank you for giving us I, N, S, inside, insight into being disabled. That's what she got out of the movie. And, yeah, it kind of blew our mind because it really, you know, it had nothing to do with that. And that's, but that's what she saw for 2 hours, that it was,
Yeah, I never saw the movie, so it's hard for me to respond to, but well, I would have to ask her more questions about what she means about, you know, in other words, like, does that mean that her view of people who are quote unquote disabled is not the same, that they, that she sees them in a way that draws her closer to them, you know what I'm saying? You know, that's the only thing I can say on that.
Yeah, I think she said something like she was like stuck on how difficult it was to get dressed and, you know, to eat your meal and to go to the bathroom, and that was the insight that she got from it. So I guess you're saying that she didn't, that she was so that was like all she could see. She couldn't see
the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. She was just stuck at that point.
Right, right. Well, that's just someone who sounds like they basically have kind of a sheltered life as far as their experiences, and then they encounter something a little bit different, and then they just, you know,
right.
And then that's all they can, you know. So that's what it sounds like there.
W H I, which was what the movie was about, was blasting that open, that the sheltered thing, blasting open the way you see the reality you're in, breaking out of the box.
Yeah, well, it looks like she broke out of one box but got into another one.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
They, O, F, often, do, they often do that.
Well, I mean, like, you know, if someone has some kind of overly preconceived idea about something, and they're not used to just encountering something new. It could be for the first time, but just saying, okay, this is something new, you know, this, and I absorb it just kind of freely. If they're not used to doing that, and they're used to this coming kind of rigid with any time, with anything that they encounter new, then often their perception about something new is often going to be very stagnant. In other words, like a little kid can encounter another kid from a different culture, and they can see, oh, they look different, they, you know, have a different language and all of that stuff, but that won't be the whole world view of how they encounter that little kid. Because first of all, they want to see if they're close enough in age to, you know, do similar things, and, you know, who's faster and all that type of stuff, you know. But that same kid, if they're conditioned, quote unquote, the right way, 30 years later, if they encountered that same person, you know, it will be like, oh, wait, I can't understand you. I can't, you know, in other words, how they'll encounter that person who has those same differences, mm-hmm. but the same commonalities, quite often they won't get to the other commonalities mm-hmm. because now they put themselves in a mindset where the little so-called perceived differences are a barrier that, you know, are just too troublesome. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not troublesome for when they were a little kid, and it's not troublesome for other people mm-hmm. who aren't in that type of box. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is the type of world we have.
The. K. The kids. The K-I. T. Kitchen. Well, this other movie we made, Out of Isolation, is about a guy who's institutionalized his whole life, played by Frank, because they think that he is retarded, that he doesn't know what's going on, which is not true. A. V. Very. V-E. Vegetable. Yeah, he's like physically, he's like, well, they think he's, that's the way they see him, that he's a vegetable. You know, he's just like, you know, he's alive, but that's it. And so he's, you know, an adult. He's been in this institution his whole life. The whole movie is just like this room with him lying naked on a bed and this physical therapist coming in every day. Uh-huh. And the movie is, it's called Out of Isolation. And the movie is about this physical therapist who's kind of gung-ho and, you know, wants to kind of get this man, you know, who nobody else can get. Mm-hmm. But she kind of gets into a relationship with him before she even knows what's happening. And it's really about that she's as isolated as he is, and they form a relationship together, and then at some, and then they form a physical relationship, and then she freaks out. It's like, this is not appropriate, you know. I don't get in a relationship with a guy like you. And she freaks out. But then, like, the last scene is where the character played by Frank, who has nothing to lose at that point, just starts wailing, and it just breaks her down, you know, and she just collapses. And then the movie stops with them just, like, rocking on the mat, the bed together. And so we screened it at this place in New York City, which is, you know, kind of this big deal, you know, to screen your video at this place that would... that wouldn't book Frank to do performances. They this the same place wouldn't, even though they had all these people saying they should, they wouldn't do it. And they were afraid. Yeah, they were afraid. You know, Frank's a troublemaker. You don't want to get him to come here and do something and get everybody all shook up. So, but they but this guy that was booking the movies had actually gone to school with Frank, and so he books the movie. And then as the movie approaches, all of a sudden we start getting phone calls from this guy saying, now, Frank, you're just coming here to show your movie, right? You're not doing a performance, as if, like, anyone had ever talked about that. And you say something like that to Frank, you know, and then he's going to, you know, well, I wasn't, but, you know, and... so the guy's getting really nervous. So he sends us a contract. No, actually, he gave us the contract when we got there. So we get... all right, so I'm going ahead in the story. So we get to New York, and we're having dinner with these native New York people, and they said, oh, yeah, we see that you're showing your movie at the kitchen. And they pull out the little mailer thing, and it's, and they had asked Frank to send a description of the movie for the mailer, and he did, you know, and it's all kind of about, like, the way I described it. What they wrote up is something they made up about a disabled man and how he deals with his disability. That's what the that's they say what the movie is about. So Frank was like, you know, just screaming, P, O, O, poor, crippled guy, W, R, O, I, write about what it's like to be a poor, crippled guy. That's the that's pretty much the way they characterized it. So then we get to the place to show the movie, and the guy comes up to us and says, we need you to sign the contract that we give to performers. Five, a five-page contract. They never have people that are showing movies sign this contract. This is how nervous they are that Frank is just showing a movie there. So we look at the contract. It basically says you promise to not offend anyone in any way by anything you do. And, you know, how could you possibly sign something like that? Frank said, well, I'll sign it, but I promise that I will break everything in this contract when I show the movie. So, guys like this. So it's like, you know, this very austere kind of thing. There's all these people sitting there, and it's very proper, and they do this introduction for the filmmaker before they show the movie. And Frank and I go up to the front, and everybody's, like, hanging on Frank's every word, and he starts out, he goes, you know, I must be a really bad actor. He said, because they wrote up, they saw the movie, and this is the description that they wrote of it. He said, but it's not about that at all. It's about an interracial relationship. And he said, you know, I tried and I tried to find a black man to play the lead, and I couldn't, so I play the nigger in the movie.
That's what he said? What did he say?
He said, so I play the nigger in the movie. Everything just dropped. All of a sudden, the smiles disappeared, and everybody was, like, really nervous. And I was pretty much all he said then. He said, okay, let's watch the movie. It is easy to C-R-A crack their C-O-N-T C-O-N-T-R control by doing something like that, if you're willing to.
All right.
Because I think a lot of people would have felt there was so much pressure, it was such a big deal to be showing the movie there, that a lot of people would have felt they didn't want to jeopardize their position or something.
Right.
Like, oh, I'll never get asked back, which we never were, you know.
Right, right.
But, so if you're willing, and then it's easier to do it, is what he's saying.
Yeah, well, like, that goes also to the form of legitimacy we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Many people want to stay within the ranks, so to speak, of being accepted, often without questioning what am I being accepted into, and am I sacrificing anything of my integrity in going into this type of situation, you know, this pack, so to speak.
Were you even ever tempted to go into the pact?
I never even considered any of that. I just kind of just operate on, you know, my own, you know, concept of the world and how I view things and my kind of positioning on friendships and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't even consider anything else because I'm more than confident in, you know, what I stand for and who I am. That my self-esteem has never been connected to being involved in something for the sake of being involved in. You know, in other words, like even though I may not believe in something, I'll kind of join that because it'll raise my quote-unquote prestige or, you know, whatever like that. I just never even thought in that term.
Yeah, Frank, neither. In fact, When? They. T. R. Try. To pull you in. Yeah, we've had many times when, when Frank has been, like, there was a, at one point, a woman that was big in the art world. I'm thinking of Linda. She latched on to Frank and, as kind of her darling, like he was her discovery, and she put him on the front of her magazine and booked him in LA and introduced all these famous artists to him and stuff. And I think, you know, others might have felt lured in by that. She wanted a G good cripple. Good cripple guy. And, you know, Frank just kept breaking all the rules to the point where she just freaked out and said, she didn't want to be our friend anymore, you know. But, you know, and, you know, he got blacklisted from a lot of places and stuff like that. And, I mean, for us, that was kind of a signal that we were on the right track, you know. But I think there are a lot of people that that would seem like a big deal. Karen, a fellow artist, where is she? In that picture there, standing next to Frank, she was someone that we knew, and then she started getting famous. Mm-hmm. And Frank actually was interviewed about her right at the time about that, and they were asking about it, and he warned that she was going to lose it, you know, that she was going to get lured into being famous and lose her power and stuff like that, which she, you know, totally did. And she would always get really upset with Frank because she was kind of on this track that what you're going for is to be famous. Like, that's what it's all about. And she just couldn't figure out why Frank didn't want that. Because she thought she's, you know, was quoted in magazines as him being her favorite artist and stuff like that. And she thought he was smart and she liked what he did and stuff. And, you know, why don't you want to be famous? And but she didn't want to hear it. You know, she didn't want him to tell her anything about it because she'd get really freaked out.
Well, you know, like I said, a lot of people's self-esteem, self-worth is it rests on some of these types of things about notoriety, famous. And when you deal within a society like that, like this, often talent may not be the real motivation of why you are quote unquote famous or receiving these type there's other players into this type of thing.
Frank has always said it's really easy to be famous. It's just gravity. But it's harder to not get famous.
So. Well, you know, like if you look at what's going on in a lot of popular music today, right now, I just heard like one guy talk about the thing to be is a producer because the artists don't have that long of a lifetime, you know, as far as in the public, but the producers do. And what has ended up happening in many ways is now producers play a much more prominent role than what they did a few years back, to the point where the market forces has created a situation where the producers often create a lot of the sound and style and stuff like that. Now, that's intentional because they want artists to be expendable, exchangeable, you know. So if you get the population just used to a couple of different types of sound, then you can get someone with the right look. They don't have to have too much talent. The right age at a particular time, this, that, and then just doll them up and then just put them out. Now, of course, the population will probably get tired of them after a period of time. So then you just, you know, and then the producer brings in, you know, that type of thing.
It is like a H O S E a hose R A rather than A W A wave in the ocean. It's like a hose rather than the wave in the ocean. They want to have J just a few F O C focus. They want to have just a focus S stream. That they can control.
Well, it's true, it is easier to control. If you have all of these types of divergent styles, creativity, personality, so on and so forth, then you have people who develop themselves over a period of time and can talk about a diversion of issues and stuff like that. It's like a situation where on the plantation, you know, you had slaves singing about, you know, the North Star and this and that, and, you know, other slaves talking about down by the river, and then another slave singing about, the little ant that needs to be squashed on the plantation because it's eating the fruit. Now, one, the one slave who's talking about the North Star is talking about escaping, you know, and following the North Star. The other one's saying it's down by the river that you first make the escape. And the other one who's talking about squashing the ant that's eating the fruit is talking about killing the slave master. Now, the slave master, if he knew what these slaves were talking about, wouldn't have had him singing, you know, he just wants him singing his little songs that he taught him and stuff. He doesn't want him singing all these other songs because independent people, an independent mind, talk about things that really address their souls and goals and aspirations. In other words, things that are not just easily marketable. So, of course, they want to streamline it and gumpify it down as much as possible. And, you know, if they do that to you, then, as we've been saying before, they have you in the box.
And when someone like Karen, who is S U supposed to be alternative, R E A really is M A mainstream. It T U turns would be would be radicals. A around AR radical artists. They're modeling that she's, that was the thing that Frank gave her a hard time about. He said, if you're going to go mainstream, go mainstream, but don't pretend that you're not going mainstream because it confuses, you know, it's like she was somebody that a lot of people looked up to and saw as a model of, you know, like you know, a radical artist. Mm. And she used that to go mainstream. That was like her shtick. Mm. And so he was saying, if you're going to go mainstream, but don't pretend that you stand for something. There is no thing wrong with going mainstream, but when she's subverting, by her going mainstream, she's subverting the possibilities.
Well, it sounded like she just found a little marketing strategy.
Exactly.
And she just went with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I. P. Did. Oh, the poetry thing? Is that with the bookstore? Yeah, well, I mean, she would get nervous when we'd show up at one of her performances. I am bad. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so she, you know, she got to where we couldn't afford to go to her performances anymore. You know, they were way too expensive. And but she was reading at this little bookstore here. This is a few years back. She had a new book out about spoofing Martha Stewart. And Frank said, why bother spoofing Martha Stewart? Mm. But anyway, we saw her on Tom Snyder, and, you know, so we knew what we were getting into by going, what she was doing. So we go, the place is packed. I mean, you just couldn't move, and it's all these young girls that are just kind of like hanging on her every word. Mm-hmm. And all, you know, punks and pierced and all these kind of like alternative type people that are just googly-eyed over her. So it feels like she had a lot of responsibility. Who? Don't know. Who don't know Martha Stewart. You know, they're just there because it's Karen Finley, whatever she's there to talk about. So there we are, and she sees us, you know, we're in the back, and she's kind of like, oh, you know, hi, you know, like that. And she starts talking, she does her thing, and it was tragic. You know, you look around the room at all these young girls, and they're just waiting for her, you know, and she's talking about Martha Stewart, and you watch this process of them eventually starting to feel like, well, maybe this is something important, you know, and so they're going, you know, and kind of going along. So at the end of it, she's taking questions. So, you know, Frank has me raise my hand and said Frank wanted to know if you would read your poem, Black Sheep, which, see, we were prepared because we had seen her on Tom Snyder. And we had published her poem in we had a zine for a while. Uh-huh. Really powerful poem about being a black sheep and the feeling of being isolated, but, you know, but having to do it anyway, having no choice. Uh-huh. And so she gets kind of pissed, you know, but then she just kind of covers that up. And she goes, oh, well, gee, Frank, I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of it. So Frank said, oh, I do. I pull out the magazine, and I have to walk down this long aisle and to bring her the magazine. And she's shooting us like killer looks. And all the young girls are, oh, I'm so glad you're doing this. You know, this is what they came for, the passion, you know. And look, when she had finished her talk, there was this polite applause, and, you know, and then so she starts reading this poem, and at first she's doing it like her Martha Stewart thing, but the poem is so strong that it kind of transcends that, and the passion kicks in through, and so by the second half, she's just, it's like really powerful. Everybody stands up, they're applauding, it's just like, you know, it's magic, you could just feel it, and, you know, so that was, Frank actually ended up writing a piece about that got published in a lot of, you know, alternative kinds of things, where he kind of used that, and he blasted her for not identifying her switch to mainstream.
It sounds like going after Martha Stewart, she's just trying to play it safe.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You could do a Martha Stewart parody forever.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Then L, she, S, said that Frank doesn't support women's work. That was her response to him, her critique. I, T, thought she meant women, artists. He thought she meant that he doesn't support women artists, which he thought, you know, why is she saying that? Because, you know, we had a lot of friends that are women artists. Mm-hmm. But it's just so, and then they, as they engage in this dialogue, it turns out what she means is housework. Mm-hmm. And she's calling housework women's work. And so Frank said, gee, I didn't know that was women's work, you know. We all do it around here.
She's all backwards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Huh. That is a M A Y major W A way they K keep people in the box.
Well, it sounds like she did. She was one person that was had one foot in the box in the first place
from the beginning. Yeah. That's what we always thought. Yes, but she represented something to
well,
other
I mean,
people.
We have a style over substance society. You know, James Dean is often cited as some kind of super rebel, and it wasn't like he was some fighter of the system or anything. You know, it was just based off of some movies and driving a car real fast until he drove it off a cliff. So that's just more style over any kind of real substance. But, you know, that is the way many people in this society want you to view yourself as far as being an outsider or a rebel. Because that's safe. That's containable. That's not a threat to the system.
Yes. Yes. They, in reality, it is C O N N E connected to the S-T-S-Y system. In reality, it's connected to the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, we have a society that often it has many ways of kind of diffusing and diverting your energy. And if it can get a lot of people to spend a lot of time doing things that will get them certain notoriety, have them give a certain persona, but not be a threat to the legitimacy of the overall structure of the society that we live in, then, you know, everything's fine with them.
Some are A radicals in Q in quotes would will not come on this show. Right, because of the erotic stuff of Frank's art.
Well, I mean, you have, like, people who are into, like, they're radical into certain forms of lifestyleisms, you know what I mean? In other words, they don't really oppose the system, per se, but when it comes to how they dress, or, you know what I mean, or what kind of drugs they can take, then, you know, then it's the free-for-all, you know. So, I've known people who've been like involved or are really into the whole marijuana scene, you know, in like the High Times and all of that type of stuff. And their whole world centers around that aspect. Now, when it comes to the McDonaldization of the planet that's taking place, they can more or less care less. When the imperial policies that the same, you know, so they're radical when it comes to the independence of what they, you know, are able to put into their body and stuff like that. But, you know, the other stuff is like, oh, I don't, you know, that type of thing. So, we have many people and a culture that has various ways of expressing itself and demanding its like independence. But if you're caught up in just a narrow viewpoint of personal independence and don't interconnect yourself in other ways of what true human independence means, you can easily find yourself in a bottle where all you care about is a particular form of, you know, that you eat food that's not genetically modified, but you don't fight for the fact that many communities are polluted by, you know, industrial plants and stuff like that.
Right. D, F, R, A, fragmentation, fragmenting things, people, issues.
Yeah, well, I think that in this society, like, a lot of people are used to, like, talking at one another and getting caught up in their own little personal thing and thinking that that's the end all, the be all. And what ends up happening is that they'll just surround themselves with people who are only interested in the narrow things that they are. And thereby they'll end up limiting themselves from other people who are radical but are involved in other, you know, areas and stuff. So you have some people who are involved in the radical environmental movement, but they don't have contact or much contact with people who are involved in forms of radical environmental racism movements, and then those people aren't in contact with the overall, you know, what's happening to the ocean life and stuff like that, and, you know, and on and on and on. So
it is like the B L I N blind M E men on the E L E P elephant
or under the elephant getting trampled over, you know.
They don't R E realize they it is one thing they think the A R E the area that they don't realize that the elephant is one thing, the blind man sitting on the elephant, or he's not sitting on the elephant.
Blind man.
blind men. Okay, sitting on the elephant, don't realize that it's one thing, that the elephant is one thing. They want, they think, the A-R-E, the area below them, that E-A, each is A, T, T, A, attached, C, C, K, attacked, attacked, I, N, attacking, is like a separate thing. S. So they don't O R G organize. So you have all these blind men sitting on an elephant, and each one of them thinks that the area that they're sitting under is attacking, or is being attacked. Is that what you said? Attack or attached? Attacked. E. A. Each. Each man is A. Attacking. Attacking the other man. Attacking the elephant. The area that they're sitting on. Each blind man is attacking the area on the elephant that they're sitting on, and they don't realize that it's all one elephant. Is that it? They don't realize that it's all one elephant. So your point is that people act like blind men on an elephant. Ever get in to A M E M E T E M E T A
metaphor
that you realize isn't going to work, but you're in the middle of it.
Well, like in this society you have a giant elephant, and then other people think that it's a donkey.
Right.
And they think that they can ride it like a donkey, even though it's an elephant. And then when the elephant thrusts them off, they think that it's just a little donkey. They can control it better. Right. But in reality, it's just the mammoth elephant that's it's always been. But they try to get everyone to jump on the little donkey and think that they can help steer that into a better direction when, at that time, the whole planet, including themselves, are being stomped to death by the elephant.
He saved you. And on that note, L, I, S, listen to Slave Revolt Radio every week on Lover on Thursday nights at 11 p.m. And Tracy is the host with Gerald Smith.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What, when he shows up. That's right. Tracy is always there. Yeah. Gerald is sometimes there.
The slave goes on.
When is? When is it on? People who are in Berkeley can also listen to the show live on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.5 FM.
104.1.
104.1 FM. Yeah. And what day?
Friday, 6:30 p.m.
B. E. C. Because this will be on, this will also play on Berkeley's public access channel.
Okay.
So people in Berkeley will be able to get that information.
All right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Is that it? Okay, and this whole thing will be archived also on the Shaman's Den archives eventually. And Radio for All. So you will get to hear it if you miss part of it. Okay, your player's gonna stop. Hit play again.